welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host, our guest author, Francis X. Mayer. His book, True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church, published by our friends over at Ignatius Press, naturally available through our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. Fran, it's good to see you again. You know, people will have seen you on with Father Mitch when you were in talking about this book as well. And people obviously in the church know you very well for your association, long time with a member of our board for many years, our wonderful, wonderful bishop, great friend of ours, Archbishop Shapu.
He's a great guy, and it was a wonderful thing working for him. And that informed, you know, informed a lot of my comments that I make in the book.
Right. So how many years did you actually work with them? Because you were in
23 years.
23 years.
Senior aide for 23 years, yeah.
From Denver on? Was that what it
from
was
Denver called? On, yeah. Okay. It was, when I first met him, he said, you don't need to be communications chief, you need to be my chief of staff. So,
right.
And that I did that for 23 years, and it was a great relationship.
So the first time you met him was when you met him in what, in Rapid City?
Or? I met him in Rapid City when I brought our report for the diocese up to him, you know.
When he had been named.
Yeah,
right,
he had been named, but it wasn't public yet.
Right.
And I liked him immediately.
Right.
I made the mistake of calling him Archbishop when he was still a bishop.
Bishop.
He said, no, you know. So,
you were prophetic.
Yeah, prophetic, yeah. So. It was a great relationship, and it certainly changed my life for the better. I mean, it was a wonderful, wonderful collaboration.
What was the great insight you saw in him that helped your own spiritual life?
Well, you know, you could come back from any mistake with Archbishop Shapu except one, which was dishonesty.
Okay.
He was relentlessly honest. He had zero tolerance for any kind of evasion or lying, and I just enormously admired that. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that he gave, he knew how to hire talented people like the CFOs that I talked with in the book and let them do their job and then hold them accountable. That's the key. I mean, you got a lot of freedom with him in working with him if you did a good job, but you always knew he was going to circle back and ask for an accounting, which made you that much more productive.
Now, it's interesting. You actually, in Mater Magistra, in the beginning, in the introduction, you actually had him. Was that your choice to have him do it? Did he volunteer? Ignatius asked him? How did that work?
You mean the introduction?
Yeah, the introduction.
No, he volunteered to do it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it dictates a lot of stuff.
Okay.
So, and that's mainly the way that he works. And, no, it was a, that was on, that's on him.
Right. He talks about, in the beginning, about Francis of Assisi and also St. Augustine, how he was attracted to these people.
Yeah.
And but he makes the connection there to the fact that they were basically lay people.
They were lay people who then became clergy.
Right.
But his attraction to them, because he entered the Capuchins without necessarily intending to be a priest. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be a Capuchin.
Okay.
The priesthood
followed. So like a brother?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, he was led eventually to being a priest. But he admired Augustine and Francis because they started as lay people. Francis was never ordained, you know. I mean, and Augustine was corralled into it by the people in Hippo.
Right.
You know, that wasn't his intention either. So he has always worked very comfortably with lay people.
Right.
And that was the reason that certainly we had such a good relationship when we were
right, as he mentions, our Lord's followers were lay people, fishermen, etc.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he also points out right at the beginning that baptism is the cornerstone of the Christian faith. Why do you think he said that?
Because it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the core, the most important thing in the church. Once you're baptized, of course, is the Eucharist. That's the heart and soul of the church. You don't get there until you're baptized, and baptism is the commissioning of the person, the incorporation into the believing community, the forgiveness of sins, and the commissioning to help sanctify the world.
Right, right.
And we all share that, all of us, every one of us.
Well, he talks about the fact that, at least from his period of time, the pre-Vatican II coming out at the after Vatican II, basically, and the idea of how things had changed so much, and there was a lot of change for those of us who were around at that time. And he talked about the fact that it's easy to lose heart in the confusion of the times, but I offer you a useful piece of advice. Don't make that mistake. Do you think we're in similar times today?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I try to stress whenever I talk about the church is that we're very bad at remembering our history. That's partly American, because we're a Novus Ordo Seclorum, you know. We don't like the past because it's mortgage on the future, and we like to reinvent ourselves. But that's death for Catholics, just as it would be for Jews. Jews remain as a people because they have the discipline of remembering, and we need to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
So our history is really critical. And once you know our history, as opposed to nostalgia, once you really understand the history of the church, you know it can get much, much worse.
Right.
But God always brings us back. And so if we have difficult times now, and they may get worse, it's no reason to despair, you know, or it's no reason to hide in nostalgia. I mean, we have to own our vocation and go forward from that point, because each one of us is called to be a saint.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I mentioned that, I think, toward the end, the work of Georges Bernanos makes a big point of that. You know, he wrote an essay called Our Friends the Saints toward the end of his life. And it's a beautiful essay on the obligation of all of us to try to become saints. And we can do that no matter what our vocation is, you know.
Now, you were you mentioned about the fact that when you were in Denver, you were made chancellor. Now, was it unusual at that time for a layperson to be a chancellor?
No, the 83 code allowed that. But the ironic thing about that, Doug, is that I did very few chancellery things.
Okay.
You know, I co-signed his documents, which were his official documents. But all the legal stuff was delegated to a vice chancellor. Mm-hmm. Basically, the job was senior assistant and chief of staff.
So when you actually went to Philadelphia and continued to do the same thing, that's
different
why you
title,
weren't,
yeah.
you didn't have a different same.
Right.
I was going to ask you, why did you have a different title?
Because in Philadelphia, it's a metropolitan see, and uh-huh. and they have their own very elaborate, you know, system of the chancellor is a canon lawyer,
right.
serious canon lawyer.
I see. So you attended with him besides the World Meeting of Families, obviously, which we covered back in 2015, and you were at several of the synods.
Three of them.
And he talks about that. What was your impression of the synods?
Well, 97 was brand new. I mean, he had just been appointed earlier in the year as archbishop, and he had been appointed by the Pope personally. And it was just exhilarating, you know, it was the Synod on the Americas. And he actually met Bergoglio, Jorge Bergoglio, because he had also been made an archbishop. They got along very nicely at the 97 Synod. So it was a great experience. The 2015 and 2018 Synods were very different. I mean, they were, let me put it this way. Every Synod is to some degree choreographed. You know that.
Sure.
Because there are certain things that the Pope wants to accomplish. But I think there was a kind of unpleasant manipulation that went on at the 2015 and the 2018 synods that certainly my archbishop really didn't like. You know, he was a delegate to both of those, so they were very different experiences.
Right.
I'm glad I was there. I saw it firsthand. I was his support there, but. Yeah, it was a different experience.
Right. So you say in the beginning that the book is a snapshot of the Catholic Church in the United States in the third decade of the 21st century based on your perspective and the many years you've served inside the church.
Right.
So is it developing well, or is it a pretty bad picture?
No, I think it's a great picture. In fact, I say in the book, you know, that when I started working for the dioceses that I worked for, I was worried I was going to lose my faith, or at least have it undermined. It was exactly the opposite.
I found the same thing.
Yeah. You know, you see the warts, you see the sins up close, but the people you work with are just so much better than those problems.
Right.
And it was a tremendous environment. And so in writing the book, I think I mentioned this at some point, you know, I write for a living now, and I get tired of what I say because I get tired of that whole kind of commentariat that goes on.
Which you originally thought you were going to write, and then decided against.
Yes,
right.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I did that for 45 years instead, you know. But I mean, I did the book because I wanted to know what normal faithful Catholics thought, from the bishops down to ordinary lay people, and that experience was just fantastic because people. Are frank, and that's sobering, but it's also very encouraging. I mean, you hear the truth, and the truth sets you free. It doesn't necessarily make you happy, but it does encourage you that you're living in an environment that has
oxygen.
And
since you wanted honesty, is that the reason the vast majority of people, certainly in the beginning of the book, that you're dealing with at different levels are anonymous?
Well, the bishops I gave anonymity, that was my idea.
Okay.
Because you're never going to get a bishop to be really frank, because they can't. I mean, they have to be prudent in what they say in terms of public consumption, because what their words are so easily misread. Once they feel safe, they do tell you what they think. And these guys were a very impressive group of people all over the country. The bishops were that. The only other group that I gave anonymity to were the what I call the formators, because a number of them are on faculties,
I
and they
see.
Could get canceled. And so instead of leaving some anonymous and some not, I just gave them all anonymity.
Gave them all, okay. Yep. You say no attempt was made to eliminate unwelcome or inconvenient views or to force the content in directions unintended by the person speaking. Go on to say the point of this book was to hear the experiences, insights, and opinions of others and not to share them without an interpretive, and to share them without an interpretive filter.
Right. Yeah, I didn't want to, I mean, again, I have an opinion about almost everything, as my wife likes to remind me. But I didn't want that interfering with what real people thought. And so to the degree that I could, and I hope I was honest, I think I was, I let them say what they wanted to say. And I think that comes through on the pages.
You say my faith has always been in large part a left brain affair. How
yeah,
so?
Rational.
Okay.
You know, I don't normally have spiritual ecstasies. I'm more systematic. Somewhere I say, I don't know if it's in the book or not, but I'm a very skeptical person. The glass is
you do say you're skeptical.
Yeah, yeah.
And a glass half full.
Yeah,
you talk about
yeah,
that
always.
Perspective,
I mean,
right?
Unless proven otherwise, you know. But I have had experiences that were really quite spiritual and moving, and I think most people have them at some point in their lives. It's not something that happens all the time, but it can really change your life when it happens.
You see, we're living through a sea change in our politics, economy, culture, and self-understanding, and the church has survived such changes before. And you quote Rosa, who talks about, but there's an acceleration and alienation going on.
Right.
That's kind of new.
Yeah. Well, here's an example. Here's a fun fact. You know, in 1993, when I began working for the Archdiocese of Denver, there were less than 200 websites online globally. Okay. Now there are more than 2 billion. Mm-hmm. That just captures in a line the radical difference in technology, information circulation. And that has huge cultural consequences. And that's accelerating because technological breakthroughs create a momentum for more breakthroughs. You see it with the development of artificial intelligence now. And nobody can get their feet on the ground. You know. And the church, remember, has been for centuries written and print-based culture, you know, and now everything is shifting. Everything's shifting to visual imagery and things like that. So it's a time, a decade ago, and I remember the Archbishop laughing about this when I told him. I said, we're living through a second Reformation, and everybody thought I was nuts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they're laughing anymore. Mm-hmm. What I meant was literally reformation, the differences between...
Not that Martin Luther was showing up again.
No, I mean, it's a completely different cultural environment, but the fundamental event of the moment is this deep reformation of the way that we think about culture, the way we consider our own humanity, and that's
right.
That creates a lot of turmoil.
You said, I've always believed in our potential as Catholic Christians to be a leaven in American life. It just hasn't worked out that way.
Right.
I mean, that was kind of the idea of Vatican II. We were going to open the windows and everybody was going to, and the doors, and everybody was going to come Catholic.
Yeah, it didn't work out that way.
Father Benedict saying that was people thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
Instead, the world rushed in.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, Benedict, I mean, to his, it's amazing. When you reread the talks that he gave to German national radio in 69 and 70, Ignatius has a book that's based on that, Faith in the Future. He foresaw all this. I mean, the man was incredibly brilliant. He was absolutely prophetic about the moment that we're at now, and he saw that more than 50 years ago.
Right.
I think that there was a naivete. I'm a big Vatican II guy. Okay? Mm-hmm. I need to put that out on the table.
Sure.
I mean, I support it very strongly. But there was also a lot of naivete about what would happen when you did that.
Right.
There's a lot of centrifugal forces that were built up over centuries that then were suddenly released, and we got a lot of confusion.
Well, I think sometimes you took the historical, you know, people look at Trent or look at others and they say, well, you need to understand that in the context of the times. Well, you need to understand Vatican II in the context of the 1960s too.
Yeah.
Because that had a big impact on the milieu that impacted what people thought was happening in the world at
yeah.
the time.
Yeah, I think, Humanae Vitae in 1968, which is truly a brilliant document, but it also raised it highlighted the issue of sexuality in a way that hadn't explicitly happened before, you know? And I think the resistance to Humanae Vitae accelerated the whole unraveling of sexual morality in the later 60s and the early 70s,
right,
in a destructive way. So, so much of our life right now is arguing over sex, which is ironic because the whole thing was supposed to be put on the back burner and not taken very seriously.
You said our country is draining away, and you make the point about your eldest son going to West Point. Would he go today?
You'd have to ask him. Mm-hmm. I certainly wouldn't encourage him.
I was going to add that, I guess, was my point.
And I love our country. Mm-hmm. I love the best ideals of our country, but it's not the same country I grew up in, and that's disturbing. Mm-hmm.
You know. Now, in the chapter, you talk about bishop speak, and one of the things you talk about here, the idea of collegiality, and I remember hearing the cardinal from Chicago, of late great, mm-hmm. Was talking about collegiality in Rome, and he was saying it doesn't mean that we all get along; it means we all teach the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they certainly don't.
Right.
Pardon me. They certainly don't all get along because they're human beings.
Right.
You know, but I think the disturbing thing for a lot of people now is that they're not all teaching the same thing, or they're not all implying the same thing in terms of, particularly of sex. I mean, sex is, ironically, it is really the central issue of so much of the turmoil in the church right now. So that's not been resolved as to our sexual identity and. You know, John Paul was brilliant in the sense that, and it was carried on by Benedict XVI, I mean, he was brilliant in creating a Christian anthropology. And I think what some people are troubled about is that seems to be unraveling now in the current pontificate, you know, because of social science, the rise of social science as an arbiter of truth.
Right, right.
You know, and that's dangerous. Really dangerous. You know, if you want to know...
Well, the father of sociology was big on religion, as I recall.
You know, and Christopher Lash, who never was religious, was ruthless in his criticism of social science because of its destructive effect on the family. Mm-hmm. He saw, and this was a man on the political left, he saw the family as the centerpiece of a healthy culture. Mm-hmm. And social sciences directly undermine that in a lot of ways. To have that then invade the church is extremely dangerous, I think.
Now you have bishops basically from urban dioceses,
rural dioceses,
etc. This particular one talked about, you know, said certainly Pope Francis has great love for the social mission of the church and for the poor, but he goes to point out that the Pope should be the principle of unity in the church, and instead Francis fosters ambiguity, which tends to feed division. Do you think he's ambiguous on purpose?
I don't know.
Okay.
You know, I'd like to be able to answer you, but I don't know. I think he doesn't like the experience of rigidity that he seemed to have in Latin America, and that's kind of formed the direction that he's taken in a lot of his
right.
a lot of his sayings. And I think that expresses itself in his habit of speaking very very loosely, off the cuff. And you know, on a human to human level, that can be quite charming.
Right.
When you're teaching and leading a global church, that can be extremely unsettling to a lot of people.
Right. You said it was a quote from a bishop in an urban/rural diocese. He said, "I think the way we currently form young Catholics often vaccinates them against actually believing once they're out in the big world." What do you think he meant?
Well, I think that's true. I think that to the degree that we communicate ideas, doctrines, which of course are really important, you know, and don't inculcate an emotional passion for preaching the gospel and a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, we're defeating ourselves. Because as a purely intellectual, when people move out of Catholic environments into a much more secular environment, you're going to run into people who are very smart and don't believe. And unless you have something in your heart that keeps your ideas alive, you're going to lose. And that's happened in the United States in a big way.
In the section where you talk about priests and the road less traveled, the parish isn't a sacrament factory, one priest says. If it becomes one, the relational aspect thing becomes impersonal, which has happened again and again. You have parishes in some dioceses with 4,000 households officially on the books, but only 100 people, a surviving remnant, coming to Mass on Sundays, yet they still do things the same way they always have.
Mm-hmm. That's nostalgia and it kills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people hang on to the past in an unhealthy way. And again, I mean, the sacraments are rooted in a life. They're not sort of like gas station pumps that you drive in and you get up, you get gas.
Right.
You know, I mean, it has to be rooted in a living experience of Jesus Christ. And if you don't have that, if the parish is just dispensing mm-hmm. sacraments, you're going to lose.
Right.
And parishes shrivel up because of that. You know, people have to be flexible enough to understand that the church has to an appropriate degree, adapt to the times and deal with reality on the ground. And if people are stuck in their heads with, well, you know, we have to have the St. Patty's party. I think he mentioned
right,
that.
Right, that's
you
the know? Reference there.
Yeah,
yeah
I
right.
mean, look at I'm half Irish. I love St. Patrick, but young people are they're not connected with that because
right.
we're not an immigrant church in the same way we were 50 years
right.
ago.
And probably most of the people in that particular parish aren't Irish anymore.
they're Hispanic. You know
yeah.
what I mean? They're Archbishop Jose Gomez was an auxiliary in Denver, and he got to be a good friend. And he said what was really weird for him as a Mexican American was going to a St. Patty's party, which was inhabited by a whole bunch of Anglo-Irish guys,
right.
and talking about St. Patrick. I mean, it was completely new to him. You
right.
know, it wasn't part of his cultural experience.
Right.
So the church has to be adaptable in those ways.
Right. This one, Reverend Philip Larry.
Yeah, Larray.
He makes a point, which I thought was really, indifference towards the faith due to secularism, also, he was talking about what's wrong, also our lack of belief in the afterlife. Christianity doesn't make sense without a profound
right.
eschatological point of view. You know, the reality is, if there's no downside to my behavior, why are you bothering me?
Yeah, what does this crucifixion mean?
Right, right.
You know, I mean, did we even need it? I mean, if you don't believe in the afterlife, if you don't have a vivid sense of it, and I don't mean a kind of a psychotic attachment to fear of hell,
right.
but I mean actions have consequences in this life and in the next. And if you don't really believe that, it all begins to fall apart.
But we see in a society today that we're trying to have actions with no consequences. We see that with what's happening in big cities. People do things and we explain away why it's really not their fault.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, also there's what I suggest people who see this, try to keep track of how many times you see or hear the word sin mm-hmm. used in secular or public mass media.
Mm-hmm.
It's disappeared.
Right.
You know, because there isn't sin. There's like psychological problems or social, you know, problems. But it lets us all off the hook right. wrongly in terms of our personal responsibility.
Now, you've been in the church, and you've been in the church bureaucracy for years. One priest talks about how it's harder these days. Gumption is not only not rewarded, but it's regarded with a level of suspicion that's just stunning to me. And that's why sometimes people wonder when they go to the parish, and the parish priest isn't looking to do anything particular, because how many times is he going to have his hand slapped? There's an old expression, parents don't want justice, they want quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really...
Well, there's a truth to that,
a truth in most bureaucracies, whether it's the church or not,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think you're quoting there, I think, a permanent deacon who's
right.
a married man, great guy, very sharp brain. And the peace is a good thing, but not in the face of, people draining away from the church.
Right.
You know, I mean, you have to speak the truth and take the consequences.
Right. Absolutely. There was a question you put to a religious. Why do you think women's religious vocations are relatively sparse now? She said obedience is not a high value in America. Women religious say they want to be treated as adults. And then you run into that virtually everywhere where, you know, this idea you're supposed to follow this because these are the rules. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, I shouldn't have any rules because I'm just as smart as you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're not free until you learn how to learn. You can't lead until you learn how to follow. Obedience is a good thing. And in an American culture of intense individuality, unhealthy individualism, actually, it's sort of... it's derided in a way that's unhealthy, but you're free when you're obedient. Obedient
right.
are the guardrails for your life. Now it can be abused, but I don't think the church does that very often.
And there's so much in here. You've got an homage to some good men, including obviously Archbishop Chaput, who people will know is. He mentioned the quickest way to reform the USCCB is to limit the money it has. That means reducing offices and staff. I can't think of a single useful thing that the USCCB did for me in my more than 30 years as an ordinary.
Yeah, that's the typically subtle remark.
Mm-hmm.
It was very direct and true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think I think he was more, and he served toward the end of his career in positions of committee leadership in the USCCB, which he tried to avoid for years, but you know, finally gave into it. But I mean, he was very direct, and structures tend to reduce, they actually sometimes work to reduce productive collegiality rather than to help it. Mm-hmm. And it does absorb an awfully lot of money that could be used.
Right, you lose that entrepreneurial ability to make quick decisions and move quickly.
Oh yeah, you can't. I mean, when you got X number of hundred of bishops, you're not going to be able to.
Yeah, herding cats.
Yeah, one of the bishops in there talks very specifically about that it doesn't matter what the majority want. If you have a minority that is determined, it's going to the whole thing.
And even if the document comes out, there's got to be some. Yeah. But of course.
Yeah.
Now, True Confessions, Voice of Faith. Now, there's a great movie.
Yeah.
1981 that you relate to in this, and your background as wanting to be a script writer.
Right, I did that for 6 years.
Right, and you were an analyst. You found you were a better analyst than you were a script writer?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a memory that I have that we made a living at it for 6 years, which was very nice. Mm-hmm. I was a full member of the Writers Guild of America West, which is, at that time anyway, a big deal. Mm-hmm. But it was an environment that wasn't very friendly to people who had religious convictions of a serious nature. And then I stumbled into working for the National Catholic Register, which was owned by the wonderful family, the Frawleys at the time. That just became an addiction for me. I just loved it. I did that for 15 years as editor-in-chief and then moved on to diocesan work. But the experience, Doug, I mean, I think you would be sympathetic with this. The experience of working in the church is one of the really great blessings of my life.
Right.
I mean, it was vastly better than I thought it would be when I started. I love priests and bishops more now than then, and I know them a lot better, including their warts. The church is just a marvelous witness, marvelous vessel of the truth.
And what they're up against, and they need support, and that's what the lay people are supposed to be doing out in the world.
Which we don't do very well, by the way, or a lot of us don't. Yeah,
it's good to be apostolate versus ministry is an idea. All right, great.
God
Thank
bless
you so
Doug.
Much.
Thanks so much.
That's okay. Francis X. Mayer, the author of True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church. We just scratched the surface from Ignatius Press, now available through the EWTN Religious Catalog. Highly recommend checking it out. And check us out next time right here on EWTN's Bookmark. Thanks.